You're connected to NPR's All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan with our summer 2005 book list, the best music books worth taking to the beach. And we start off the show with a musical quiz and three guests. And the first question goes to our guest in Philadelphia, Tom Moon. He's a writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer and a contributor to this show and All Things Considered. Tom, how many chords will it take you to name the musical genre?
Oh, dear.
Here goes.
Okay, rock.
Okay, let's get more specific.
Southern rock. Oh, wrong.
Keep going. Power pop. Okay. No matter what you do, I will always be around. Okay, so surprise me. So next quiz. Two guests in New York City. Will Hermes, a senior contributing writer for Spin magazine, and I'm guessing and betting on Will to ID this musical genre before we hear the music, Will. Let's see if I'm right.
glitch hop.
Okay.
Music concrete.
It tells of how a large black cloud descends into Times Square, straddles out across 42nd Street, turns into wall and sucks in Manhattan Island. Our hero, named Rail, crawls out of the subways
the
of
engineer
New York
got it.
And is sucked into the wall to regain consciousness underground.
Musical genre.
This is the story of Rail.
Prog rock.
Got it. All right. Let's hear a little.
Lamb Lies Down on Broadway?
That's right. The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway by Genesis. Let's just hear, just a tiny bit. And you can sing along if you want. As soon as Phil hits the drums. That's true. It takes a while. Okay, so I said we had three guests. Our third guest.
Don't ever tell anyone I did that.
Meredith was watching me play air drums. I said, don't well, ever tell anyone.
Well, we had the engineer, was doing the keyboards. Our third guest is Meredith Oakes in New York. She's a DJ for Satellite Radio's Outlaw Country Music Channel. She also contributes to All Things Considered, as the other two do, and the musical genre is
post-punk new wave.
Are you getting close? You're getting close.
Pop rock.
You got it. Pop rock.
Yes.
Very good.
Well, Tom's going to redeem himself, but let's hear some Brinsley Schwartz. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? Brinsley Schwartz, of course, Nick Lowe there. Well, according to a new book by David Camp and Stephen Daly, the Rock Snobs Dictionary, two of my three guests right now have earned the status of rock snob.
Wait, we're supposed to be proud of that?
Well, it's also something, you may be proud of it, and it's something that may have happened to you a long time ago. Tom Moon, I'm sure, is going to redeem himself. Meredith
I
Oakes.
Can't imagine how.
I can't imagine.
I'm actually wiping my brow going, whew, I'm glad I'm not a rock snob.
Well, I think this book is clearly written by a couple of conflicted rock snobs. There's no
how
way
so?
That I just don't think that anybody who's not a rock snob could have written this book, because it shows a mastery of arcane knowledge that only a rock snob, if a closeted one, would know. That's just my theory.
Right, and clearly a person,
I don't know either of these guys, but...
Yeah, none of us do. But they're definitely people for whom the accumulation of knowledge is more important than the music.
But
clearly.
But it's fun because by packaging it in this, you know, as a rock snob's dictionary, you get to sort of make fun of the rock snob.
And they do make fun of them.
Exactly. Yeah. At the same time, they're sort of being a rock snob. It's very... Very savvy. So
for examples, in this little book, The Rock Snob, there's a guide to the snob nomenclature. So how to correctly identify esteemed rock personages in conversation with other snobs. So if you're talking about Bob Dylan, you wouldn't say
Zimmy.
Bob Dylan. You'd say Zimmy. There you go.
No Mo Tucker. I mean, no Maureen.
There you go.
Got to be Mo.
You got it.
You are a rock snob.
You're bringing it up from the... If Ron Wood were playing guitar, who would you say was playing guitar?
Woody?
Who said Woody?
Woody.
Well done, Will.
Very good, Will. Now, this is one I never knew. Robert Plant. Robert Plant. Who would you say? This boggled me. Percy? Anybody?
Golden God?
I don't know. They say Percy.
Percy.
Okay, so that was. I think they made that up.
Percy is a name that only British people know.
Where's Chuck Klosterman? He would know that.
I'll read about pub rock. Meredith, maybe you have a favorite. Pub rock, which we played the Burnsley Schwartz, fry-booted, nicotine-stained British mini-movement of the early mid-70s, poised over eager critics in rock's pre-punk dog days as an antidote to Prague and concept album Torpor. There were good-natured, charisma-free chugglers such as Burnsley Schwartz, Ducks Deluxe, Bees Make Honey, and it goes on.
I'm partial to Bram Tchaikovsky myself.
Are you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Girl of My Dreams. What a song.
Here's another rock snob test. Did they list Eggs Over Easy?
Oh, I don't remember that.
In pub rock? They're a great, great lost pub rock moment.
I never heard Eggs Over
Easy. Dude, you're snobbing us.
Yeah. It's coming up.
See, I was trying not to.
Right, yeah.
You coming can't up help yourself. The rear.
Don't play He's poker. Don't himself. Play poker with Tom.
So the
Rock Snob Hall of Fame has Elvis Costello, Beastie Boys, Jack Black. And I didn't know David Chase, but maybe I'm not a TV watcher. David Chase, anyone?
Right, The Sopranos, because there's so many just hip little music drop-ins in that show.
Right. Talk about a job for a rock snob.
Yeah.
And there was a Hall of Shame, too. Does anybody remember the Hall of Shame?
Yes, I know Jeff Lynne was in the Hall of Shame. And Paul McCartney was in the Hall of Shame.
I don't know.
So
Jeff
wrong.
Lynne is
so
being
wrong.
Reevaluated.
We can all agree that Jeff Lynne does not belong in the Hall of Shame.
I'm ready to call these folks up because Jeff Lynne did piss me off.
I think that was designed to piss us off, though. Okay. I really do.
I mean, they make a dismissive remark about Delaney and Bonnie. They make a dismissive remark about Delaney and Bonnie in the introduction. And it's like,
they should have, actually.
Right, but perhaps maybe not. But, you know,
in
the cycle of things, every 5 years, something's going to be rediscovered for a moment to be reclaimed for a moment. That's going to happen over and over again. You know, maybe Delaney and Bonnie just are sort of off the cycle right now.
They've been off my cycle since I saw them in 1969 playing. They opened for Blind Faith, and at the end of the show, I'm sorry.
You're a rock snob.
Yeah, I know. At the end of the show, they came out with Eric, and they did I can't remember the song, and it made me cringe so bad. And for that moment on, I never bought an Eric Clapton record. It was the end of Eric Clapton for me. I just didn't think they ever had it. And
they were in that movie Festival Express, weren't they?
I don't remember.
I seem to remember them being really dreadful.
Let me see if that's in the book. Yeah. Anyway, the Rock Snobs Dictionary. It's an essential lexicon of rock psychology and knowledge. Anything else you might want to say about this book, Meredith?
Other than that it's completely hysterical, and when I picked it up for the first time, I read it all the way through and could not put it down just to make sure that I knew everything in it already.
I was a little annoyed at it because it got almost everything right, and I was flipping through it like trying to find, like, they must have missed something here.
Right.
And it was actually very hard to find, you know, other than maybe not mentioning the birth of techno in the Kraftwerk entry.
I think they had Kraftwerk under Krautrock.
Kraftwerk and Krautrock are both next to each other, separate entries.
You've memorized these.
I know.
It's important to him.
I don't think Bob Marley's in this book.
Oh, well, probably because he's too... I mean, they sort of describe at the beginning, like, the criteria, and I guess that he's too widely known.
Yeah.
What I asked you all to do is pick out some of the best books about rock music. And, Tom, you picked the Bob Marley book, Catch a Fire, The Life of Bob Marley.
it's one of the few rock or music biographies that gives you the whole lay of the land of a scene. And if you read this, if you go with Timothy White, who's the late Timothy White, who's the writer, who was a journalist in the early days of Spin, wrote a lot for Rolling Stone, and spent a lot of time with Marley starting in around 1975. He doesn't necessarily just start with Bob Marley. He tells you the origins of Rastafarianism. He explains the culture that was in Jamaica at the time when Marley was born. He spends a lot of time with Marley's parents. I don't even think you get to Marley until 100 pages in or something, 60 or something pages in. We all know some reggae. We hear Bob Marley all the time, but there's something about having the context and the land sort of set out before you the way Timothy did it here that's just genius. It's like, you know, it's very engagingly written, but more, it's really well researched.
The fascinating thing I think you mentioned as well is, I don't know about you, but the Rastafarian culture is so, I can't understand it. I've never been able to make heads or tails of it until I read this book, or at least I had a pretty good handle on it once I read this book. But there's some stuff in here where, and I'll read a passage about Marley going to Africa in December of 78. He's gone to Ethiopia. And we can explain this, that Haile Selassie was thought to be the, how would you say, the king of kings, I guess is the best way to put it, in the Rastafarian culture. And admired is the wrong word to use, but what would be the right word?
Revered.
Certainly. Then I'll just read. It says, when Marley finally did go to Africa the first time in December 78, he saw the same slums and hungry faces he'd left behind in Jamaica. I mean, it was always the dream of a lot of the Rastas that they just get out of Jamaica and head back to Africa. They saw the same corrupt, strong-armed governments towering over the misery. This Africa was the sole continent where virtually no modern political leader had ever been peacefully voted out of office. He entered war-torn Ethiopia from Kenya to discover his beloved Haile Selassie, the man he worshipped as God, had died in disgrace and been buried in an unmarked grave. The absence of any memorial to the man, coupled with the open contempt which the Ethiopians recalled for their former emperor, had left Marley severely shaken. Just one little graph from a book that's it's just an amazing book.
It remains the definitive work on him, too.
Let's listen to some Bob Marley. Let's listen to Get Up, Stand Up.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up. Fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. Is it all that Peter is told? After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on,
get up.
Marley's life was, it's a fascinating life. The book goes into how Bob Marley dies. Tom, do you want to pick up a little bit on that?
He died of cancer and suffered for a long time and continued to work while sick. And the interesting thing, after he dies, there's a good chunk of the book that's devoted to the estate and all the problems that that he essentially left behind that were unresolved about his recordings, his money, his legacy. The book flips a little bit into this snapshot of a sort of a culture in disarray because the people that were around him had so depended on him and were so connected to his world that suddenly when he's not there, that world sort of crumbles.
It had mentioned that if he had his toe amputated, it might have stopped the cancer, but he was so... You can't do that to my body. You can't take a part of my body. And in the end, I think that he wound up in the end going through some chemotherapy way too late in the process. And I think there's a part of the book that talks about how his dreadlocks were turned into a wig that he could put back on.
Yeah, there's a fairly famous photo of him doing sort of the end stage of that therapy where he's wearing a tam, but it's clear that like that lion's mane of dreadlocks is no longer there. It's very moving.
From reggae in Jamaica to the birth of Tropicalismo and Brazil. Will Hermes, you chose a book about Caetano Veloso as a must-read book for the summer or for any summer. Tell us about the book.
It's a book that came out a couple years ago, and it's an autobiography by Caetano Veloso, who is one of the great musicians of all time, not only a great Brazilian musician, but he writes about his life, and it's the most compelling, the center of it really is this musical movement that came up in the 60s in Brazil that Veloso and a bunch of his musical friends who include Gilberto Gil and Gal Costa, Maria Bethânia, who is Caetano's half-sister, Tom Jay and some other people. And they came together during a period of cultural foment that was mirroring what was happening here in the States and in England and in Europe. And it's fascinating to me because you learn about what happens in the history of your own country culturally, and you don't always realize that there are similar movements happening in all over the world. What happened here in the 60s was mirrored in Brazil with this movement Tropicália, which not only was a sort of 60s style rebellion of like, you know, drugs and free sex and all that good stuff. It also was about American cultural hegemony and how do you respond to that as being someone who's situated in a quote unquote third world country. Do you embrace this foreign influence? How do you deal with it? And Tropicália was a way of they talked about it in terms of almost a cannibalism, where the idea was that these Brazilian artists were ingesting American culture and European culture, but then they were putting out something that was distinctly their own and that that spoke to the concerns of Brazil at the time.
So you say he was exiled. In a nutshell, why would Caetano Veloso be exiled from his country?
Well, there was a military coup around the time that these artists were doing their thing in the late 60s, and for a while they were tolerated, but at a certain point they were involved in a couple of performances that just ran afoul of the powers that be. They were arrested for a while. They were in a military prison for a couple of weeks. Then they were in house arrest for about 4 months, and ultimately they were told to leave the country. This is specifically Caetano Veloso and Gilberto Gil. Gilberto Gil, who is now holds a government post in Brazil. I think he's the
Minister
of Culture. Yeah. So it's funny how these things come around. But the song was written while he was in exile. And there's a passage here in the book which is kind of moving, I thought. And it talks about when he was being held in jail and not really knowing what was going to happen to him. One day I thought I was going to die. A young soldier had appeared at the grate and was staring through the bars at me with a look of fear and pity. It was as though he knew of something horrible soon to happen, but could tell me nothing about it. In a little while, the same soldier was obeying the order to open the barred door, and I was following an officer and a sergeant to the wide perch through which I had entered on the day I arrived. The officer ordered me to walk straight and not look back. The group, made up of the officer, the sergeant, as well as a soldier pointing his machine gun at me, led me outside the building, and then, receiving an order to turn left, I saw myself in the open air, walking along a road rimmed on my right by some smaller buildings, also belonging to the barracks, some little white houses, almost all with their doors shut. The three did not speak much, and I can remember nothing they said, but the sensation caused by the solemnity of their tone is one I can still feel. It was clear they were not taking me to be questioned, clear as well that they were going to do something physical to me. The officer told me to turn right and go into the little house with the open door. It was the barracks barbershop. The barber, scissors and clippers in hand, stood there ready to demolish my famous head of hair. And that was, he wound up emerging from the experience fairly unscathed, but he did have to, he was driven into exile for 2 years and made a lot of interesting music during that period, and it certainly affected him for the rest of his career.
The book's Tropical Truth, A Story of Music and Revolution in Brazil by Caetano Veloso. I'm ashamed to say that Meredith Oakes brought a, I'm not ashamed to say that Meredith Oakes brought a book, but a book.
My mom is.
Your mother. Meredith Oakes brought a book by a person who grew up basically just a few blocks from where I live. And it's a book by John Fahey. It's called How Bluegrass Destroyed My Life. I've never read this book.
You really should, because it deals with your neck of the woods. He grew
Which
up in
you didn't like for. I don't think he had very good experiences in
suburban wasteland, as you know, many of us who grew up in the suburbs can relate to. And it was in the post World War II era, and he speaks quite openly about the stuff he didn't like about it, racism of the time, and you know that a lot of people don't speak about. You know, the '50s such a happy time. He really sort of takes you into the underbelly of it. Part of it is truth, part is fiction. It's a lot of hallucinations, which, you know, John Fahey was a really weird guy, if you ever saw him play, you know.
And let's just
his
say
playing
that
is part, like, hallucination, you know?
That John Fahey's a guitar player, we should start
oh, right,
off.
And of course.
And quite an amazing, influential guitar player and influenced, well, let's make the list.
Now, whole schools of music, the entire Wyndham Hill label. You could
That's right. I mean,
it's
some people say, in a funny way, that he was the godfather. Maybe it would be in the punk, in the rock snob, or maybe that would be the folk snob dictionary, the godfather of new age music. But in
which he hated, by the way.
Yeah, no, sure he did. No, he,
with a passion,
right. But,
as he hated folk music and you know anything white. Basically, except for bluegrass, but he claims bluegrass is not really white music.
How so?
Well, in my one of my favorite passages in the book, he describes hearing bluegrass for the first time on a station that was called WARL in Arlington. Does it still exist, Bob?
Nope,
I don't
gone.
Know. And it was mostly a country station, Hank Snow, Webb Pierce. And one day, the program director, who he mentions by name, again, not sure if it's truth or fiction because part of the book is, you know, both. Don Owens is the guy's name. And John Fahey claims he changed the format and started playing bluegrass. And he says the moment he heard the song, he went insane.
Let's hear it. Bill Monroe. And that, of course, is a Jimmy Rogers tune, though. It's Blue Yodel number. Is it seven?
It's seven.
Oh, seven. It's a great song.
You don't hear seven very often. Nine. You hear nine a lot.
The seventh movement.
What a great, great tune. So how do you think that this sort of music infused itself into his playing, in his steel string playing? I mean, he's a real eccentric, and it's not like he started playing bluegrass music.
Well, that kind of takes us into another part of the book, actually, because most of this book is about blues. I mean, it just so happens that this one bit of it is about how bluegrass literally drove him out of his mind, mm-hmm. which, you know, I've seen John Fahey play, and he looks like, well, he did look like he was out of his mind.
John Fahey died, two, 3 years
or
ago?
Or just really, 60, really drunk.
Which he 61. Usually was.
Yes.
In fact, the one time I saw him play, he was really drunk. He was wearing these, like, stained sweatpants. His eyeballs were rolling around in his head. And it was, like, the most electrifying thing I'd ever seen in my life. It was so exciting. And all these kind of, like, folky, you know, sort of, like, 80s folk yuppie types who he detested were there. They were all complaining and saying, that was horrible. But to me, that was punk rock. It was amazing. It just completely turned me on to all these blues and country artists who influenced him.
Yeah, yeah. I remember watching him play a few times, and it's like you're on this ride, and you're on the edge of your seat as to whether he's going to fall over.
Right.
Or then he, like, you know, would
like
peel
Iggy Pop,
off these,
you know?
Yeah, these amazing licks, and it's, yeah. great artist.
So, you know, he loved blues. He loved black music. Can I just read this little bit about Blue Yodel No. 7 that he says? He calls it the bluesiest and most obnoxious thing I had ever heard. It was an attack of revolutionary terrorism on my nervous system through aesthetics. It was blacker than the blackest black record I'd ever heard. It reached out and grabbed and has never let go of me.
Wow.
And then he says, you see, I had gone insane. It's a great book. You know, it just starts in the mid-50s in D.C., takes him through his travels, and, you know, like I said, part truth, part fiction, part hallucination.
How Bluegrass Destroyed My Life by John Fahey. Another great American eccentric telling his tale is Bob Dylan, and his book that came out last year is called Chronicles, Volume 1. Tom Moon, a nice, simple read that clearly lays out the life of Bob Dylan. reads like a child's biography, right?
Just everything's in chronological
like a
order.
Book report.
Yeah, like a book report. That's what I was thinking.
It's actually one of the most confoundingly structured things I've ever read, but yet it doesn't matter. It's wonderful, like, in its skipping aroundness. And a lot of the characters, a lot of the people he was around at the time are not mentioned. You don't know which wife he's with when. And yet he remembers other things very clearly. It's almost like he was very careful to keep his family out of the book. Yet he can recall being in someone's apartment in the early 60s in New York and which books were on the bookshelf and which ones he pulled out. And he gives these wonderful descriptions of being in New Orleans in 87 making Oh Mercy and just what it felt like to him to walk around New Orleans. And at the time, he was recovering from a pretty bad hand injury, mm-hmm. which I didn't remember. He goes very deep and then flies miles away from that and takes a bird's eye view of something. Then he goes someplace else entirely.
Hmm. Let's listen to a little bit of the record that you were just talking about, Oh Mercy, which that was the first of the Daniel Anwak CDs, correct?
That's right, yeah.
And let's listen to everything. A little bit of Everything Is Broken.
Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs, broken idols, broken heads.
I don't know if you've picked out a passage, Tom, from the book. This is just something that I went randomly back through the book and pulled this little thing out. It says, a few years earlier, Ronnie Gilbert, one of the Weavers, had introduced me at one of the Newport Folk Festivals saying, and here he is, take him, you know him, he's yours. And then Dylan says, I'd failed to sense the ominous forebodings in that introduction. Elvis had never been introduced like that. Take him. He's yours. What a crazy thing to say. Screw that. As far as I know, I didn't belong to anybody then or now. I had a wife and children who I loved more than anything else in the world. I was trying to provide for them, keep out of trouble. But the big bugs in the press kept promoting me as the mouthpiece, spokesman, or even conscious of a generation. That was funny. All I'd ever done was sing songs that were dead straight and express powerful new realities. I had very little in common with and knew even less about a generation that I was supposed to be the voice of. I'd left my hometown only 10 years earlier, wasn't vociferating the opinions of anybody. My destiny lay down the road with whatever life invited, had nothing to do with representing any kind of civilization. Be true to yourself, that was a thing. I was more a cowpuncher than a Pied Piper.
Amen.
Yeah, that's a great book.
It is, and a lot of it is like that. He's very generous with his descriptions of other people. He's, you know, he's a storyteller. He sort of makes me think I'd love to read a novel by him. Although, you know, who knows how much of this is a novel, but right. I'd love to. You know, he has sort of an Elmore Leonardish way of just rolling you through a scene.
Wasn't Tarantula a novel that he wrote?
Yes,
which I didn't read.
I didn't read it either.
It's probably in the Rock Snob Dictionary.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're only a rock snob, really, if you've read Tarantula.
I have it, but I've never read it.
Yeah. It's, the Dylan book really is great, and it actually shares a lot with the Veloso book in that they're both really rambling, and you know, they'll be talking about something that happened a long time ago and then sort of shoot to the present
detail.
And discourse about films and books and other musicians. It's almost like having a conversation with somebody that's really smart in a bar, and you just sort of are happy to listen to them. And I think it's something that makes for a good summer book, is something that's kind of conversational and you're not necessarily, you know, stuck to the storyline that's going from here to there to there. It's
right.
more random and free associating.
That's right. You can read two pages of this and just really get, you know, a real nice focused dose of Bob Dylan.
And it says volume one. Who knows?
The estimation was that it would be three volumes total.
Wow.
I hope he has time to finish them all.
Yeah. Here. So now I think the most fun book to read, and this is another one you can pick up in little bits and pieces and still get the gist of it. This is Please Kill Me, The Uncensored Oral History of Punk. Meredith Oakes, tell us about this book. It's a compilation of sorts.
It is. It was put together by Legs McNeil, who did the original Punk magazine, and Gillian McCain, who ran like poetry workshops and presentations in the East Village. And what it is they cobbled together interviews with musicians and groupies and managers, all these people from pretty much, it goes from mid-60s Velvet Underground Factory to like 79 when punk died and everyone was overdosing. But what they do is they make little blurbs of everybody's interviews, and they organize it chronologically rather than individually. So it's kind of like a back and forth, which makes it sort of gossipy, because you hear like what Patti Smith thought about someone and then what they thought about her and who was sleeping with whom. And it's just such, you get the most vivid picture of New York in the 70s, with little glimpses of Detroit and LA and London where punk rock was sort of erupting. But it's mostly a story about, you know, Bowery, CBGBs, Max's Kansas City. And it's a great summer. It's like a summer, you know, trashy novel, kind of.
All right.
But it's told in the voices of these people.
And it's fun because this format, the oral history, it's an interview format.
That's right.
So basically you're reading...
without the narrator.
Yeah, you're reading
exactly.
So-and-so says blank, and then blank. And so, it just...
There's one thing I wanted to read that Legs McNeil actually wrote, although many interesting people are interviewed in here, Lou Reed and Tom Verlaine and Richard Hell and all these folks. But to me, this was like the biggest revelation, because I thought punk was political when I was a kid, like the Clash, Crass. You know, the New York folks hated that stuff. They thought the Clash were suburban posers.
Right.
But anyway, Legs McNeil, this is him. Punk was like, this is new, this is now, the apotheosis, powerful. But it wasn't political. I mean, maybe that is political. I mean, the great thing about punk was that it had no political agenda. It was about real freedom, personal freedom. It was also about doing anything that's going to offend a grown-up, just being as offensive as possible, which seemed delightful, just euphoric. Be the real people we are. You know, I just loved it.
A couple of things I pulled out, too. This is also Legs McNeil, but then it goes into Joey Ramone. This is Lou Reed and I guess Legs McNeil and other people sitting and seeing the Ramones at CBGB's. They counted off the song, 1, 2, 3, 4, and we were hit with this blast of noise. You physically recoiled from the shock of it like a huge wind, and before I could even get into it, they stopped. Apparently they were all playing a different song. The Ramones had a mini fight on stage. They were just so thoroughly disgusted with each other that they threw down their guitars and stomped off the stage. It was amazing. It was like actually seeing something come together. Lou Reed was sitting at the table laughing, and then the next graph is Joey Ramone. That was the first night we met Lou Reed. Lou kept telling Johnny Ramone that he wasn't playing the right kind of guitar, that he should play a different kind of guitar. It didn't go over so favorably with Johnny. I mean, when John found his guitar, he didn't have much money. He bought his guitar for $50. And Johnny liked the idea of a Mosrite because nobody else used a Mosrite. So this would be his sort of trademark. So Johnny thought Lou was a jerk, a real jerk.
Let's go!
you know what? Now, like, three quarters of the Ramones are dead. I'm so glad that this book was written when it was in the early 90s. They started it. Came out in 96.
It's called Please Kill Me, The Uncensored Oral History of Punk. We have one book left. It's called Stranded, Rock and Roll for a Desert Island. Desert Island books are so much fun. And this is a book that was edited by Grail Marcus. Will Hermes?
Yeah, came out in 1979. It was reprinted, I think, in the mid-90s. But what better thing to read on the beach than a book about people's fantasies of what they would do on a desert island? The book collects essays from, you know, really the first generation of people who are writing about rock music, Simon Frith and Alan Willis and Dave Marsh and Ed Ward and Lester Bangs and Robert Christgau. Some of the records are, you know, it's not like the greatest records of all times. I mean, some of them are idiosyncratic. Robert Christgau writes about the first New York Dolls record. It's like, would I want that? My only on record desert on a desert island? No, but Robert Christgau does and makes a great argument for it. Tom Carson writes about the Ramones' Rocket to Russia. Janet Maslin writes about Something Else by the Kinks, which was a choice that resonated with me. Ellen Willis writes this great essay, which starts by changing the parameters of the essay assignment, which I love. You know, rather than writing about being on a desert island, she begins a change of fantasy. I have just won the first annual Keith Moon Memorial Essay Contest. This year's subject was, Is Ecstasy Dead? The prize is a fallout shelter in the bowels of Manhattan, reachable only through a secret entrance in CBGB's basement. It is fully stocked. On entering the contest, I was asked to specify my choice of drugs, LSD, junk food, Milky Way, T-shirt, Eat the Rich, book, Parade's End, movie, The Wizard of Oz, rock and roll single, Anarchy in the UK, and rock and roll album. The album is Velvet Underground, not to be confused with The Velvet Underground. It's an anthology culled from the Velvet's first three LPs. My specially ordered version of this collection is slightly different from the original. For After Hours, a song I've never liked, it substitutes Pale Blue Eyes, one of my favorites. So just being persnickety the way a good critic can often be. Anyway, from there, she jumps to talking about the Velvet Underground record, and specifically a song which is probably my favorite Velvet Underground song, if not one of my all-time favorite songs, I'll Be Your Mirror. And
hey, Will, do you like the mono version or the stereo version? I'll keep going, because I've got both, you know.
Go for the stereo version. I love these universal reissues. Yeah. Getting onto the subject of the music. She writes, for the Velvets, the roots of sin are in this ingrained resistance to facing our deepest, most painful, most sacred emotions. The essence of grace is the comprehension that our sophistication is a sham, that our deepest, most painful, most sacred desire is to recover a childlike innocence we have never, in our hearts of hearts, really lost. And the essence of love is sharing that redemptive truth. On the Velvet's first album, which is dominated by images of decadence and death, suddenly, out of nowhere, comes Nico's artless voice singing, I'll be your mirror, the light on your door to show you that you're home. When you think the night has seen your mind, that inside you're twisted and unkind, please put down your hands, because I see you.
Bum, 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 bum.
Bum, bum, bum.
Let's hear it. All right.
I be your mirror, reflect what you are, in case you don't know. I be the wind, the rain and the sunset, the light on your door, to show that you're home. When you think the night has in your mind, that inside you're twisted and unkind, let me stand to show that you are blind. Put down your hands, 'cause I see you.
Everybody sing along. The wonderful thing about Nico is that it was okay to sing along, because you'd be on key just about
can't
as she was.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
Well, I don't know. Every time I think about whether I could pick a record for my desert island, I'm always stumped and stuck. When I was younger, it was easy. It was always Sgt. Pepper for the longest time. I don't know what I do anymore. Do you guys know what you do?
Bram Tchaikovsky. Just kidding.
No, I actually do. I think I would probably choose Brian Eno's Another Green World because it has these like little instrumental bits that I could see just sort of listening to in the background. And then when I get really bored, then suddenly a nice song comes along to kind of grab your attention.
I think it has to be the Kinks' Village Green.
And Tom?
Yeah, that's a great record. You know, if it was today, since I just listened to this, it would be Marvin Gaye, What's Going On.
Well, we better get stranded together so we'll have some variety.
An iPod.
Thanks, everybody. And maybe I'll ask now for anybody out there who's listening to write us and let us know what their favorite disc would be in the spirit of what Grail Marcus put together, their Desert Island record, and perhaps we'll put a show together of those. Thanks to Will Hermes, Meredith Oakes, Tom Moon. It was fun being with a whole bunch of rock snobs. Tom, you redeemed yourself.
Thanks.
Many times over.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you.